into this show. Essentially, here on SDF and on radio, lots of people like to talk about computers. It's a really easy, normal thing to do when you're on a, you know, it's just like ham radio people, right? You tune into conversations over ham radio, and what do you hear? You hear them talking about antennas.
Yeah.
In the same way, on SDF and on radio, you frequently hear people talking about computers. I want to talk about the whole world of technology and human society that is not in computers. So,
I'll let you take it. I'm going to drop. I'll be in the chat.
Okay. And yes, so I am on the voice conference bridge, 1088. It's an interesting question whether we want to really do this as a dial-in show where other people call in. I'm thinking about doing that in the future. I'm also thinking about doing this as a pre-recorded show in the future. Again, we're still trying to work out the details. But two of the major things I plan on talking about in A Step Farther Out is atomic energy and space travel. And people say, well, what's so important about those two things? I say, well, they are the two key facts of our world because they release us from limits that existed before. Essentially, at the very smallest scale and the very largest scale. Now, what do I mean when I say that they release us from limits? Well, here's the thing. I can't think because of the lawnmower running outside. No. What are the boundaries of human experience? Well, for all of our history, down basically to the 20th of July, 1969, we were creatures of the one planet Earth. And you probably remember, you know, the Carl Sagan pale blue dot thing. We sent out a space probe, which, by the way, was powered by nuclear energy, the actual circuitry of it. It was launched by chemical energy, but its power was nuclear in origin. And it went out past Jupiter, and it took a photograph looking back towards the sun, and the entire Earth was a single pixel. Now, and Carl Sagan waxed rhapsodic about all the things that people have ever fought for, things that people have ever killed and died for, all the things that people have ever loved, you know, all those things were compressed to a single boop in the midst of infinity. That's kind of a big deal. You think about how futile it is, right? All right. You think about how futile it is. During the Cold War, the United States and the Soviet Union, between them, built well over 100,000 atom bombs for no other purpose than for each one to threaten the other with being wiped from existence. Because neither side, of course, wanted to use them. So they built these atomic bombs. Well, Freeman Dyson, in the 1960s, there was a big disaster, basically, where several hydrogen bombs were lost due to a B-52 colliding with a tanker aircraft off Spain. And a couple of them fell on land, and a couple more fell in the water. And Freeman Dyson, it may have been, did a calculation to try and figure out how much energy was in a 10-megaton hydrogen bomb, and he realized that, on the basis of the laws of orbital mechanics, you could use it to take, like, 100,000 tons of cargo to Mars. So those are two facts, right? The first fact is that the Earth is a tiny particle in the midst of an immense universe, and we are accustomed, through a species of cognitive blindness, to pretending that it's the only thing that matters, when the truth is that, in a very real sense, it's the opposite way around. That the Earth only matters because we're here, living on it, and working with the raw materials it gives us, right, living in the context of the biosphere it has created, right? If we can find a way to do those things other places, then there's no point in fighting over the Earth, in murdering each other by millions for possession of this tiny speck, when everything that this tiny speck can provide is available in billions of times larger quantities if we will just look beyond the blue veil of the sky. So that's important. energy, material, and knowledge. And energy is key because energy is a substitute raw material, right? If you are running out of a metal, you just have no more ores for that metal. Well, you could say maybe we can find another metal. Or you could say we can recycle scrap. Or you can say, well, an ore is an ore because it's a rich source. But if we're willing to spend a little more energy, we can use poorer sources, such as seawater, right? Magnesium metal can be used in place of many other metals for many purposes, not all purposes, but many purposes. It can be obtained from seawater rather cheaply, as a matter of fact, as long as energy is cheap. Think about that for a minute, right? So energy is a key. Energy is a key in another way. It has greatly accelerated the intellectual and moral development of the human race. You say what? I say yes. All right? So down to the year 1600, in fact, down to the year 1700, we'll say, down to the year 1700, aside from what small amount could be squeezed out of wind and water mills, which were not general-purpose devices, but they did some work, all work had to be done by the conversion of chemical energy to mechanical energy by muscles. And sometimes this was by animals, but frequently it was by humans. And that is labor. It is travail. It is toil. And then around the year 1700, Newcomen comes along with a steam engine where you can burn fuel, coal, a form of chemical energy that's not usable for human food, and you can get mechanical work out of it. And Newcomen's engine wasn't all that useful, but about 50 years later, a guy named James Watt comes along and makes it a lot more useful by modifying it in fairly modest ways. And suddenly, toil, right, brute human labor, the use of human beings as nothing more than mildly self-directing prime movers, begins to go away, and it begins to go away quite rapidly. Indeed, the need for human intelligence to operate simple machines begins to go away immediately as well, because one of the first things that happens when a steam engine begins to become popular is the invention of automation. There's a piece of equipment attached to a Watt or Newcomen steam engine known as the piston, and it opens the valves and closes them automatically based on the stroke of the piston. It's called the piston because, originally, a man had to stand in the pit and open and close those valves. But within a few years, perhaps within a few months, it's not clear, within a few years of the engine being brought into operation, some intelligent pitman noticed that the times he was opening and closing the valves always corresponded to a particular stroke of the piston, and so he could hook the valves up to the piston and go and do something else with his day. So the use of brute human labor and the use of the lowest use of human intellect to simply operate machines are no longer necessary because we have instead applied technic sources of energy to the problem. And what does that mean? It means that people who previously were little more than beasts of the field, who spent their entire lives gathering energy in the form of food and fodder and fuel such as charcoal, right? And who spent their entire lives converting that chemical energy into mechanical energy for the benefit of someone else, those people suddenly have a chance to do things like get educated. Right? Though you have to remember, every human civilization, the heights of human civilization, we think of classical Athens, there were perhaps a few thousand Athenian citizens. Right? A few thousand people who engaged in philosophy and art and literature and created really wonderful monumental works of those things. And they were supported by 100 times as many slaves. It's no coincidence that in the shadow of Boulton and Watt's steam engine manufactory in Birmingham, England in the 1750s, the first really effective society for the suppression of slavery got started. Right? You see their symbol, their medals, even today, the two hands, one black, one white, clasped with the slogan, "Am I not a man and a brother?" big deal? Am I not a man and a brother? But what that means is that the progress of industrial technology, which many people don't like very much, many people regard industrial technology as something horrible that, you know, has been done to us, right? This is the anarcho-primitivist mindset, which is the mindset of the core of the green organizations and explains why they oppose nuclear energy, among other things, that are environmentally actually better than the available alternatives, right? These are the banana crowd, build absolutely nothing anywhere near anything. They get a lot of help from people who don't have that mindset, but that's what the core is. Anarcho-primitivism, the idea that we're better off without these things, without, you know, written language and all those things. There's very few people who believe that. And the people who do believe it are almost exclusively people who have never had to toil. They are almost exclusively people who have never had to worry about tainted water. They are almost exclusively people who have never had to worry about infectious disease or puerperal fever or any of those other things, right? In the year 1900, it was still true that no more than a third of infants born made it to age 15. Today, in the wealthy countries around the world, a child who dies before reaching the age of majority is an exception, is a tragedy. Whereas for our great-grandparents, that was just how life was. Similarly, we talk about the U.S. has terrible infant mortality, I'm sorry, has terrible maternal mortality statistics compared to other industrialized countries. But still, compared to the situation in 1900, it's a complete revolution. I mean, my great-grandfather, Carson Freeman, you think of the psychological effect of that, the total difference in mental outlook. I mean, I can hardly imagine how anyone could get, you know, how any man could get married with a clear conscience in 1900, knowing that the likely outcome was that his wife would die within 20 years. Can you imagine deliberately doing that to another human being? And yet, that was just the way life was. It was inescapable. It was the order of nature. It was as God has decreed. And then, you know, with the advance of science and technology, we decided we weren't going to do that anymore. We decided that if that was the order of nature, then nature could get stuffed, right? We were going to have our own order. If we decided that this is what God has decreed, well, it's been nice knowing you. I mean, that's not what Nietzsche meant when he said God is dead, but if people genuinely believe that that's what God has decreed, we decided we didn't need that anymore. So what are we to conclude from all of this? Right? What are we to conclude from all of this? Well, I will say firstly that the high energy society is morally good. The denial of this is the central argument of the Green Movement. And I say that not based on any interpretation of my own, but based on the literal statements I can read you out of a book, literal statements made in public debate by the founders of organizations such as Friends of the Earth in the 1970s. In fact, I can go you one better. I can read you a statement made by the energy policy advisor to President Carter, who said, and I quote, "The use of energy and the search of energy and the search for energy are bad." In so many words, I believe the absolute opposite. The use of energy and the search for energy are bad. Well, I don't believe that at all. What I believe is, of course, that we have to behave. Right? We have to behave in a civilized manner. We have the ability, for the first time in human history, for every human being to reach the kind of intellectual level, the kind of cultural level that was enjoyed by the elites of past societies, the elites of Renaissance Italy, the elites of classical Athens, who created such incredible works of literature, such incredible political, you know, contributions to political thought, to everything. And amazingly enough, this was even anticipated in the work of classical Athens. Believe it or not, a word for it, get out Aristotle's Politics. Aristotle spends a lot of time in a convoluted apologia for slavery in which he attempts to prove that some people are just natural slaves, that some people just aren't capable of directing their own lives, and so they have to be enslaved, and it's good that they should be enslaved because that means they can do something useful for the benefit of someone else. He never gives any convincing explanation how it should be that the people who actually are slaves are the same people as these natural slaves. I don't think anyone has ever come up with a convincing argument for that. Now, C.S. Lewis turned the question on his head, and he said, all right, supposing some men are fit to be slaves, who are fit to be masters? And he answered, nobody. But that's not the point that I want to make. The point that I want to make is this. After all this convoluted and strained justification of slavery, which you get the impression he doesn't give. Of course, if machines could be made to work by themselves, there wouldn't be any need for slaves. Think about that. Let's see. I've got a comment on, I'm reading Com as I go along, and there's some interesting conversation going on about Luddites, for example, who I blame Henry VIII more than anything else, who wrecked the guilds because he, as well as the church, because he was trying to get rid of alternative sources of legitimacy in order to bring everything under his own power, as well, of course, as he needed the money. I sometimes think if the guilds had lasted long enough to get hold of a steam engine, we'd have colonies on Saturn by now. In case you're wondering what I mean by colonies on Saturn, it turns out that Saturn is a gas planet of the surface. The surface gravitation there is a little less than that of Earth. The density is a little less than that of water. You could build enormous habitats which would actually float in the cloud layers of Saturn. Some of those really fascinating thoughts. But yes, if the guilds had gotten the steam engine, we would have colonies on Saturn by now. Let's see. We also have a comment. We have all the energy we need in the sun. Well, I'll give you a hint. Jerry O'Neill's High Frontier talks a lot about solar energy, and he makes some very good points. Solar energy is an immense source. The sun produces enough energy in the course of 24 hours to melt and then boil a mass of ice, the mass of the Earth. That's pretty amazing. And for the foreseeable future, most of the human population is on the Earth. The Earth. What is the Earth? Well, the Earth is spherical, roughly. It rotates. It has a blanket atmosphere over it, which are three extremely unfavorable conditions for doing anything useful with solar energy. Here on Earth, we gave up on using solar energy along the sun is limited, right? We have, you know, in the form of biomass, again, that was running short by the 1500s, which is why Europe was almost totally deforested in those days, and Europeans began to go to the Americas to get wood to make ships out of. That was why in the Tudor period the British went to North America to get masts for their ships, because they had cut wood in order to burn charcoal. If you've ever watched a TV series called Connections, that was a pretty good one. He talks about that. So, bioenergy is great, except you're going to use it much faster than you can replenish it. It's been calculated, for example, that you could feed the energy demand of the United States for a year from the entire mass of wood in the territory of the United States. And then what do you do for 20 years while it grows back? Not a good idea. So, you know, people talk about wind, they talk about solar, and, you know, the truth is that all of these schemes have serious problems. Back in the 1870s, the French government sponsored a huge amount of work on solar power. There had been some very impressive demonstrations done, and they came, and the period then was more favorable for solar energy than it ever has been since. And that's for several reasons. The time and place were very favorable. Firstly, France had relatively small coal reserves. France was industrializing rapidly, but had small sources of coal and had to import a considerable amount of coal from other countries, which might not always be friendly, such as Germany and Britain. Okay. Second, the amount of coal needed to produce one horsepower hour at the shaft in those days was roughly 10 times what it is now, larger than it ever has been since. Thirdly, electrification, electric motors, had not been invented yet. That meant that all power was distributed power. Solar only works on a distributed basis because it comes very thinly spread over large areas, so you have to collect it and use it locally. In those days, the same was true of other power plants. If your power plant was worked by a water wheel or a steam engine, it was all basically the same. It drove a big shaft that ran along the entire length of the factory, and you had belts coming down to run each of the machines. Now, 15 years later, the scene was completely different. Those central power plants had vanished, every central in the case of one per shop, and given way to much larger, more central power plants with economies of scale. Why? Because every machine in the new factories was driven by an electric motor. This was convenient because it meant you could arrange the machines any way you wanted, but it also meant you could build much bigger thermal power plants. Well, a big coal-fired power plant, or even a big hydro plant, as it turns out, is much more efficient in terms of kilowatt hours produced per year per dollar invested. And a dollar invested is really a measure of how much human work and human blood, sweat, and tears went into it. So, for the same amount of work put into building power plants, once you have electrification, you can get a lot more work out. It isn't true with solar. The area of solar collectors to produce a certain amount of work just stays constant. Period. Nothing you can do. Absolutely nothing you can do about that. It's just a fact of nature. You get the maximum zero air mass insulation, and then you subtract the amount that's diffused by the atmosphere on a perfectly clear day coming down from, straight down at noon, and then you deduct the amount for atmospheric attenuation to your actual latitude, and then you deduct the amount that corresponds to the fact that it's not noon all the time, and so the sun's rays are coming in even more obliquely most of the time, and then you deduct another percentage for, and of course there's night, it doesn't work half the time at all, then you deduct another percentage for cloud cover and mist and haze and so on, and it just looks worse and worse the more you think about it. Basically, bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger collectors. This is a problem, because those collectors require raw materials, they require human labor, they require energy to produce. That's why we don't use solar power, right? That's why we don't use biomass as much, which we have to go out in the field and collect, and there's only so much of it. Another thing that made 1870s more favorable than any time since for solar is simply that, in those days, lighting, right? Without electric lighting, most factory work was done during daylight hours anyway. And yet, in the 1870s, in conditions which were more favorable for solar than any time since, in a country which was more favorable for solar than it has been since, the French government came to the conclusion that it just wouldn't work. Now, what can we conclude from this? Well, France still has a shortage of fossil fuels. What did they decide to do about it? Well, in the 1970s, they decided they were going to use nuclear fission. Because that's the key, right? Since the 1860s and the publication of something called The Coal Question by Gibbons, it had been very clear that our modern civilization was heavily dependent on fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are going to become harder and harder and harder to get at because we use the most accessible ones first, right? So the benefit gained from each additional increment of using fuel was going to go down and down and down. And that was a problem, that eventually we'd reach a point where we could consider the fossil fuels exhausted, not in the sense that there were no more, but in the sense that we didn't get any net benefit out of the effort needed to extract a lot sooner. Bit of a problem. What other choices do we have? People started looking around for other choices because beginning in the 1860s, again, work started to harness solar energy, and it just didn't look like it was going to work to power the industrial civilization we were building, which meant that something awful was going to happen. Now, people were distracted by something awful that was happening much more rapidly. The world was going to run out of food by 1930. And then Fritz Haber came along with the process for fixing nitrogen, and the massive worldwide famines of the early 1930s, which would have occurred owing to the exhaustion of the Chile saltpeter deposits, believe it or not, fossilized bird guano, were averted. We didn't have a 50% fall-off in global food supply in the 1930s. We had a depression, but it was totally unrelated. What's the consequence? Well, we secured our food supply at the cost of needing fossil fuel, because the Haber-Bosch process began with coal, nowadays mostly used natural gas. That's a problem. So people began to say, well, now, not only everything about the way we live as modern people is dependent on fossil fuels, but even our food supply, our very lives are dependent on fossil fuels. What do we do? What do we do? We've only got a couple of hundred years to solve this problem. It's 300, 400, 500, 600 years maybe at the outside until the coal is exhausted. And that's even if the people in the poorer countries in the world don't industrialize like Europe and North America have. Well, what do we do? And so a lot of people came up with a lot of different schemes, including, you know, giant hydro projects, including damming the Mediterranean. Atlantropa. The thing they don't tell you about that project, most of this more complex project, which would also have involved creating a giant lake in the center of Africa, among other things, and frankly, probably involved, you know, genocide against the so-called less valuable people of the world so that the more valuable people, the white people of North America and Europe mostly, could use those energy resources. Not a comforting thought, is it? But in the early 1920s, the mechanism of the energy of the sun was discovered. At least, hints were discovered. And work then began on thermonuclear fusion research to unlock atomic energy. Up to that point, radioactivity, fascinating as a source of energy, but no practical value almost. But this meant maybe a controllable source. Work began with the expectation it would take a couple of hundred years. We're about in the middle of that period now. We still don't know. And then in the fall of 1938, something really weird happened. A couple of chemists in Germany discovered a complete shortcut to the release of nuclear energy. And thus, in principle, solved the problem. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.